Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, today, this evening, we're going to have with us Jeffrey Smith. We're going to be talking about his book, Seeds of Deception. Now, we hear a lot about genetically modified food, and of course, the government insists that this is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Won't it be wonderful why we can create foods that are and seeds that are actually resistant to pesticides, so we can spray Roundup on the fields, and it won't kill the seeds at all. It'll kill just the weeds, but it won't kill the Roundup-resistant products we have. We can, make better corn. We can make better tomatoes. We can make better cotton. We can do all these wonderful, wonderful things with genetic modification. And, of course, people who oppose genetic modified food are usually relegated to the lunatic fringe. But, of course, the question is, are there problems with genetically modified food that we're not learning about? We certainly know that in Europe there's been tremendous opposition to genetically modified foods. What do they know that we don't, or what do we know that they don't know? And for that reason, I've asked Jeffrey to be with us this evening to talk about his book, Seeds of Deception, which we carry, because the book is subtitled Exposing Industry and Government Lies About the Safety of Genetically Engineered Food. Jeffrey, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you got started on this, because you certainly are out in the front lines of trying to expose the dangers of genetically modified foods.
Well, about 10 years ago, I went to a lecture by a molecular biologist who outlined some of the potential dangers of genetically engineered foods to the environment and to human health. Now, at that time, virtually no one in the general public was aware of these. In fact, not a lot of evidence, not a lot of progress has been made in the bulk of the American people, but still it was kind of a hidden technology coming on the scene. And unlike air pollution, for example, where you can clean it up, with genetic pollution, you're making decisions now that can exist for the future of life on Earth, because you're creating changes to organisms that reproduce themselves, spread their pollen and spread their animals and whatever. So it's like, I realized at that time, we're dealing with one of the most fundamental dangers that we could possibly be having on Earth, and very little research was going on in terms of the safety. So I'm a kind of person that likes to share information that I get. I'm an educator of marketing, communications, and all that. So I started giving lectures on it and worked for a nonprofit group that tried to get the foods labeled, ran for U.S. Congress to raise the public awareness about the health and environmental issues. I worked at a GMO a detection laboratory. We evaluated the presence of genetically engineered ingredients in foods and crops. I was vice president of marketing there. But still, at the end of that work, I was aware that very few people in the United States were aware of the substantial dangers, particularly to human health. And even many of the activists around the world shied away from talking about the health dangers and simply talked about the fact that there were not a lot of tests and that we needed more tests.
All right, will you hold that thought for just a minute? Because when we get back, we want to talk about the scientific studies that show the very real dangers of genetically modified foods. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Jeffrey Smith. And, of course, there really have been a lot of studies done on genetically modified foods, and those were originally done in animal studies, weren't they?
Well, yeah, there's been actually only, well, in terms of peer-reviewed published safety studies, maybe a dozen, dozen and a half studies, some mostly done by industry, and many agree that it was designed to avoid finding problems. Nonetheless, there have been problems found over and over again.
Now, of course, you tell the story of this one scientist who was actually employed by industry, and he was, of course, feeding the genetically modified foods to animals. And what happened to those animals, and what happened to this man when he tried to bring out the truth of what he'd found while working for industry?
Well, if you're talking about Dr. Arpad Pusztai, that was he worked actually for what was supposed to be an independent research laboratory under a UK government grant, and it was supposed to be setting up the testing protocol for the UK government, which was eventually going to be the testing protocol for the EU, to evaluate genetically engineered foods. Now, he fed rats potatoes that were genetically engineered to produce their own pesticide. However, the rats that ate the genetically engineered potato developed damage. They had potentially precancerous cell growth in their digestive tract, smaller brains, livers, and testicles, partial atrophy of the liver, damaged immune system. And it wasn't the insecticide that caused the problem. It was somehow the process of genetically engineering the potato that caused the problem. He went public with his concerns on television with permission from his director, was a hero for 2 days at the Institute, and then allegedly 2 phone calls were placed from the Prime Minister's office, forwarded through the receptionist to the director of the Institute. And the next morning, the director fired the scientist after 35 years, silenced him with threats of a lawsuit, and then released a series of statements that defamed him and defiled him and protected the industry by trying to rubbish his study. Eventually, he was able to speak before Parliament and get his data back, and it now is published in The Lancet, and it remains the most in-depth animal feeding safety study ever conducted on genetically modified foods. Now, I asked this scientist what was the most shocking moment, and it turns out it was months before this firing when he was still in good standing. He was a pro-biotech scientist, and he had an opportunity to review the confidential submissions that were made from the biotech industry to the UK government that got their soy, corn, and tomatoes approved for consumption in England. And he said reading the safety studies by industry was the most shocking moment for him. It was a turning point in his life.
We'll hold that thought for just a moment because we're going to bring all of our stations back right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Jeffrey Smith. We're talking about his book, Seeds of Deception. And, of course, there are things that you are out there in the listening audience are never going to be allowed to know about. And the reason is because they don't want you to know. But there was an English scientist whose name I will not try to repeat. Arpad Pusztai. Anyway, he was, of course, hired by an independent laboratory over in Great Britain that was setting up standards for testing genetically engineered food. And of course, when he fed a genetically engineered potato to a series of rats, why these rats had precancerous growth and they had didn't grow full size and poor testes. All of these animals were damaged by eating this genetically engineered potato. It was genetically engineered to create its own pesticide, but it wasn't the pesticide that bothered the rats. It seemed to be something in the genetic engineering process. And when this information was released, why he was a hero for 2 days, and then, of course, the call came from the Prime Minister's office there in Great Britain. The gentleman was fired. The scientist was fired. He was defamed. He was attacked. How dare he make these irresponsible statements? Because they did not want the people of Great Britain to learn the truth. Well, eventually, he was able to get his material back, and, of course, his information spoke before Parliament. And the reason, of course, in Europe that there's so much against genetically engineered food is that they actually had heard this story, a story you're never going to hear in the United States. And then, of course, Jeffrey was saying that the real turning point in this scientist's life was when he actually read some of the inside information put out by the people who were evaluating genetically engineered food. Would you like to take up the story right there?
That was an incredibly great summary. Thank you. Yes, Dr. Pusztai said this was while before he was fired. He was still, you know, in good standing, working on a $3 million grant from the government. He had a chance to review the confidential submissions that were used to approve the genetically modified foods in the UK. Now, he was completely shocked when he read these studies. He was totally flabbergasted because he realized at that point, he said to me, I realized what the industry was doing and what I was doing was diametrically opposed. What I was doing was safety studies. What they were doing was as little as possible to get their foods on the market as quickly as possible. Now, he realized after he had discovered the damage, how damaged his rats were from eating the genetically modified potatoes, that if he had submitted his potatoes to that same superficial industry research which got their soy, corn, and tomatoes approved earlier, the potatoes would have been approved, because they never looked for potentially precancerous cell growth, and they never weighed the organs or tested the immune system. Now, what was worse, however, was this, that the soy and the corn and the tomatoes that did make it to the market were made from the same process of genetic engineering that he used to create his potatoes. And remember, it wasn't the insecticide that caused the problem. It was somehow the process of genetically engineering the potatoes that caused this problem, which was manifested in the rats. And they never checked, and they still haven't checked, the food that are currently being eaten on the market to see if it'll create the same problems for rats or for human beings.
Well, of course, it would probably take a lot longer for the people to get sick, because we live a longer period of time than the rats do.
Absolutely.
What's going to happen 10, 20 years down the line to the people who are eating these genetically modified foods? Because, as you point out, basically it produces DNA instability. This whole process of genetic engineering creates genetic instability. Would you like to tell, you know, I was amazed to hear how they actually were able to fire the genes or get these genes into the,
DNA.
One type of gene into the DNA of the food processes. Would you like to tell us how that works?
Well, they'd like to give an impression that everything is very precise and that all you're doing is adding a gene from one species into the DNA of another, like clipping in another Lego. But in reality, it's a very imprecise and potentially dangerous process. They take genes, let's say you want to create a crop that produces its own pesticide, so you take a bacteria that produces a pesticide, you take the gene out that produces the bacteria, and you change its genetic structure a bit. You add a promoter to turn it on, you add an antibiotic-resistant marker gene, and then you make thousands of copies. You put them in a gene gun, and this is one way, and you blast those genes into thousands of cells, hoping that some of those genes make it into the DNA of some of those cells.
But you don't know what gene it's going to go into, what chromosome it's going into, do you?
You don't have any idea where it lands, if it lands in the middle of another gene that destroys it. In fact, two things are very typical that happen. One, you can damage the DNA when you insert it. It's called insertion mutation. The second thing that can happen is you can change a lot of the expressions of the normal DNA genes. In fact, one gene chip study found that when a single gene was inserted, 5% of the genes that were in the DNA already changed their levels of expression. This has enormous consequences for the possible allergies or toxins or carcinogens or nutrients in the plant. Now, that's just two of the things that can go wrong in the process of insertion. The other things are, what is it that you're putting in? Now, for example, you put in this gene that can produce its own pesticide. So now we eat that pesticide in corn, for example. Not only do we eat that pesticide, but it's possible in theory that the gene that creates the pesticide could jump from the corn and end up lodged inside our gut bacteria. Now this could potentially turn our intestinal flora into living pesticide factories. Now, have they tested for this? No. They have only tested in one case this possibility that genes can jump from food to gut bacteria, and they used a soybean. Soybeans are genetically engineered to not die when sprayed with herbicide. And they found that the gene, which confers this herbicide tolerance, did in fact jump from the food to gut bacteria. So now these human beings, including many people in the United States probably, have genes that are from this bacterium that were put originally into soybeans and are now living inside their gut.
Now, this is the Roundup-resistant type of...
Exactly.
Right. And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, you say, well, these things really couldn't be going on. Let me tell you that back in 1955, they gave the entire population the Sabin vaccine. But of course, or almost the entire population, what most people have never known is they made a mistake. Oh, it was it was just one of those things that they didn't mean to do it. They just happened to give us all SV40, a simian virus 40, a cancer-producing virus that, of course, now we're finding in cancers as the rate of cancer increases dramatically across America. We find many of the people who have cancers now actually have the SV40. Now, we know it's a cancer-producing virus because it produces cancer in every animal it's put into, but they keep insisting, of course, it doesn't produce it in men just because the rate of cancer is increasing and we find the virus in there and we know that the virus actually creates cancer. Doesn't mean that, it's creating cancer. It's just coincidence that the SV40 is in the cancers. Well, we're talking 50 years ago. And suddenly now they have this mass experiment on the American people. What's happening over in Europe? Are the Europeans going along with this? Are they still holding out and saying, we're not going to have the product because we don't know what's going to happen?
Well, in Europe, consumers are driving the train there. They're on the top of the food chain, and the food industry has taken dictation from the demands of the consumers. And so even though the European Commission has recently approved new food, genetically modified food varieties, and also seed varieties, because Europeans refuse to eat them, the manufacturers refuse to buy them, and the doors are still closed for genetically engineered products in Europe. Now, the main reason why the Europeans have that attitude, as you mentioned earlier, is because the press has been reporting it there.
And of course, here they're really suppressing it. The press, since we have five mega corporations that control the media here, all they need to do is agree among themselves. We're not going to let the American people know the truth.
And in fact, in one of the chapters of my book, it's called Muscling the Media, I describe how threats from Monsanto's attorney, letters from Monsanto's attorney, have caused the cancellation of a TV news series, of a book from being published. The concept of being sued has caused a printer to shred 14,000 issues of a magazine that was blowing the whistle on Monsanto. There were PR companies for Monsanto that created a, quote, dairy coalition in order to try and visit and convince newspapers not to run articles that were detrimental to their genetically modified bovine growth hormone. I mean, there was a very conscious effort to control the media, which has been incredibly successful over the last years. I've been reading the European press versus the U.S. press on this issue for about a decade, and by contrast, either they're completely not reporting major significant events in the United States, or they read like a biotech brochure giving the same mythology that is needed to feed the world and that it's perfectly safe.
Oh, everybody's going to starve to death unless we have these genetically modified food. I read within the last 2 weeks that there was a milk-producing company, and they wanted to print on their containers that none of this milk came from cows that had this genetically engineered growth hormone. And Monsanto sued them to keep them from putting that on there, and all they wanted to do was let people know that the milk was not going to contain this growth hormone in it. Monsanto didn't want the people to have that right to that knowledge.
And what happened was, they'd been putting this on their carton for 5 years, and after Monsanto sued them, they decided to settle with Monsanto by agreeing to put on another sentence on their cardboard box, which I'll tell you in a minute. I guess we're taking a break.
We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment with Jeffrey Smith. We're talking about seeds of deception. Ladies and gentlemen, this is such an important issue. We used to carry another book called Genetic Engineering, Dream or Nightmare, written by an English genetic engineer, until she suddenly realized the horror of what she was doing. It was a great book, and we'll talk maybe a little bit about what I learned about genetic engineering there. We used to carry the book, but unfortunately, like so many books that tell you the truth, this one is just no longer in print. But I'll tell you, after reading that book, I realized what Jeffrey's really concerned about, and you should be concerned about too. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is Jeffrey Smith. We're talking about seeds of deception. And you were going to tell us what else was on the, what the milk-producing company had to add to their statement, which said, we have no, in other words, there is no milk here that came from cows given this genetically created growth hormone. So what's the rest of the story?
Well, they added a sentence to their cartons, which said, according to the Food and Drug Administration, there's no difference in milk from cows treated with this drug versus cows not treated. Now, the particular wording of the sentence came from a paper written by the former Deputy Commissioner of Policy at the FDA, Michael Taylor. Now, Michael Taylor, before becoming the number one person in the FDA in charge of policy, was Monsanto's outside attorney. Monsanto creates this bovine growth hormone.
So he goes from working for Monsanto to a key position in the FDA?
Yes.
Why would he get a key position? You'd think he'd have to start at the bottom and work up.
Well, they created the position for him.
Isn't
during his
nice.
Tenure there, he was the one that said that he overruled the concerns of the scientists at the FDA who urged him to require long-term safety studies and said no safety studies were necessary. He completely said absolutely no labeling was necessary, and that if anyone wants to dare label their milk products as free from RBGH, they should write this sentence on there. Now, the sentence that the milk is the same is actually untrue. It's completely different than what the FDA's own scientists acknowledge. They acknowledge that the milk is different.
How is it different?
Well, primarily, the most concern that scientists have about milk from RBGH is the higher levels of a hormone called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1. Now, the background is that milk automatically or normally contains IGF-1, that milk drinkers increase their levels of IGF-1, and that premenopausal women under the age of 50 are with high levels of IGF-1 are 7 times more likely to develop breast cancer. Men are 4 times more likely to develop prostate cancer. IGF-1 is implicated in lung and colon cancer. And in milk from cows treated with RBGH, there's much higher levels of IGF-1. So this is one thing that the FDA's own scientists acknowledged, and yet this sentence says that according to the FDA, there's no difference.
In other words, the scientists have no voice, and this is really one of the frustrating things, I'm sure, for the good people who do work in government. I mean, they can report all they want to, but when the bosses, the people in charge of the FDA are, you know, on the take, and they really are, you have to see that the way the FDA works, it's a revolving turnstile going from the FDA to into government, from the FDA to going to work for one of the drug companies that they're regulating, or people coming from the companies that are regulating in the FDA. And of course, you know, if you go to work for these companies, they take care of you very well. I mean, the millions of dollars are at stake. We saw this with Vioxx. Between 88 and 139,000 people are going to die because of Vioxx by the FDA's own calculations. That's 88,000 to 139 Americans going to die unnecessarily because the FDA left a drug on the market that they knew was going to increase heart attack and strokes. And we're supposed to look to them, as responsible. And now, what are these genetically engineered foods going to do? Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Jeffrey Smith. And I think you better understand what we're really talking about, because they're talking about destroying the integrity of our food and endangering the health of every American. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Jeffrey Smith. And, of course, Jeffrey has been telling us what's wrong with the milk that comes from cows that have this growth hormone, this synthetically created growth hormone. And if you get that milk, it's not like other milk. It has a special hormone in it. And what is the name of that hormone again?
Well, it's called RBGH, recombinant bovine growth hormone, also called bovine somatotropin. And so it's either RBGH or RBST.
But what about the hormone now that we will find
hormone,
in that milk,
yeah,
that predisposes people to cancer, increases the incidence of breast cancer? What was the statistic you used?
Well, the hormone is called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1, and premenopausal women under the age of 50 with high levels of IGF-1 were found to be seven times more likely to develop breast cancer, and men are four times more likely to develop prostate cancer. And it's a very, you know, it's a great concern, and there was a whistleblowing by a Fox TV affiliate in Florida. They had a four-part news series. They were going to talk about this IGF-1, and 3 days before the show was to air, a threatening letter from Monsanto's attorney ultimately canceled the show.
In other words, they would rather switch than actually get the truth out. They can't spend millions of dollars defending themselves, and Monsanto has unlimited funds, and so the American people are not getting the truth about the danger. I mean, when you increase breast cancer by seven times, shouldn't somebody be concerned? Now, what about the scientists? If they, like the scientists, the EPA are so upset about the way they're poisoning us as far as fluoride in the water. What are the scientists at the FDA doing, or is there anything they can do already?
Well, at the time that this drug was being approved, the whistleblowers were either forced out, fired, or stripped of responsibilities. One person that had testified ended up being taken off the RBGH case altogether and moved to work at a trailer at an experimental farm. The remaining whistleblowers had to write an anonymous letter to Congress claiming that there was fraud and conflict of interest. Similar treatment happened to scientists in Canada, in their government office called Health Canada. They testified before the Canadian Senate that they were being pressured to approve RBGH, which they thought was unsafe, that Monsanto offered them a bribe of $1 to $2 million to approve it, and that documents were stolen from a locked file cabinet in a government office with research that Monsanto had. So there's been a lot of manipulation and a lot of collusion and a lot of whistleblowers sort of being thrown by the wayside. Now, you mentioned Vioxx and all. There's a controversy that the FDA officials tried to suppress the information that was going to be coming out from one of their FDA scientists. And this is not uncommon. I mean, there's a history, as you alluded to, of problems in the FDA. In fact, I'd like to read an April 1976 testimony by Richard Kraut, former director of the FDA's Bureau of Drugs. He said, "I want to describe the agency as I saw it. No one knew where anything was. There was absenteeism. There was open drunkenness by several employees, which went on for months. There was intimidation internally. People, I'm talking about division directors and their staffs, would engage in a kind of behavior that invited insubordination. People tittered in the corners, throwing spitballs. Now I'm describing physicians. People would slouch down in their chairs and not respond to questions and moan and groan, the sleeping gestures. This was kind of behavior I've not seen in any other institution from a grown man. FDA has a long-term problem with the recruitment of personnel, good scientific personnel." That was a quote from his testimony about his experience at the FDA.
And, of course, the thing is, if you are there and you try to do a good job, you're going to get into all sorts of trouble.
Well, what happened with the genetically engineered crops, they asked a bunch of scientists to make comments on it, and the scientists would submit these memos, which became public information after a lawsuit made them public, and it said clearly, genetically engineered foods could create toxins, allergens, new diseases, antibiotic-resistant diseases, nutritional problems that would be difficult to detect. Therefore, we urge long-term safety studies. And what did Michael Taylor, who was in charge of policy, come up with? No safety studies necessary. Even saying that the industry was not aware of any information showing that the foods were different in any meaningful or uniform way, that was the quote, even though that scientist himself said that the foods were different. So it was complete opposite of what the scientists in the agency were saying.
You know, one of the frightening things to me was the way that they would take as a carrier. Now, you mentioned that they would have carriers, which would be some sort of an antibiotic gene that would create an antibiotic. But sometimes they were using fish leukemia viruses or other types of viruses from one or another animal as a carrier to change the genetic makeup of crops. Did you run into that sort of thing?
Well, the viral component that I've studied is what's in most of the crops, and that's the cauliflower mosaic virus. And there's some real serious potential dangers there.
Well, we'll talk about that when we get back here after this very, very brief break here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Jeffrey Smith, and we're talking about his book, Seeds of Deception, which incidentally we do carry. We think it's a very important book, and we recommend it very strongly to you. Now, before we went to the break, we were talking about this mosaic virus. Tell us about this mosaic virus that is used as a carrier. You see, when you're going to put a gene into a chromosome or from one crop to another, or introduce a new gene, you have to have some sort of a carrier to get it in there. So could you explain how this all fits together?
Sure. If you were to just throw a gene from one species into another, the DNA in the new species wouldn't necessarily recognize it. You see, genes are turned on as needed by this incredible intelligence of the DNA. But if you take a gene from another species that wasn't part of the billions of years of evolution of that particular species, it doesn't know what to do with it. It doesn't recognize it. So the engineers put in an artificial on switch, something that turns on this foreign gene 24/7 around the clock, so it can pump out its protein at full volume. Now, they take this promoter from a virus, and it turns out that the promoter can accidentally switch on other genes inside the DNA permanently at full volume. So that, let's say you insert a gene into a corn or soybean. Now there are other genes in the corn and soybean which may be turned on permanently, which are not supposed to be turned on. And they could be pumping out potentially allergens or toxins or carcinogens or nutritional problems. And not only that, but the promoter might create genetic instability, causing the breakup and recombination of the DNA, which could have all sorts of problems. Not only that, but embedded inside the DNA of higher organisms are often ancient dormant viruses, which many are intact but simply not switched on. And so this on switch being put in there might, in theory, we haven't tested it, but it might in theory turn on a formerly dormant virus embedded inside the DNA. But that's not the worst of it. In the only human feeding study ever conducted and published, they found that the promoter transferred from soybeans into gut bacteria. So now the promoter could, in theory, turn on genes at random inside our gut bacteria or cause genetic instability, but that's still not at all. It was an unpublished study where preliminary evidence was reported in February, where they fed rats a single transgenic meal, and the promoter had transferred to the organs of the rats.
Hold that for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, Jeffrey Smith, and we're talking about his book, Seeds of Deception. Now, the whole DNA makeup and the genetic makeup is an amazing thing, but all these little genes on the helix, the spiral helix of the DNA, each one can be turned on and off. There's an on and off switch. And, of course, you turn a gene on, the gene then produces various products. It produces enzymes, it can produce toxins, it can produce carcinogens. And so when, of course, you're introducing a gene from one species to another, and they're taking a gene from a bacteria and putting it into a potato, but then, of course, they have to use a carrier to do that. And so they're using this mosaic virus. And what happens, of course, when this whole thing happens is that you may turn on other genes. You may not just insert a gene. You may turn on all sorts of other genes. And as Jeffrey was saying, in the only published study that we have, you know, in the human beings, what they found is that this is actually inserted this into a product, and Jeffrey can tell us what it was, but it was ingested, and suddenly this gene jumps to the bacteria in the gut, and now starts producing these same products in the intestine of the gut, and in one animal study, it actually got into the animals themselves, into their makeup.
That's right, and the thing is, because we're actually dealing with a very aggressive promoter which can change the expression of the DNA, knowing that it can change the expression of the DNA potentially in our gut bacteria and even in our internal organs, we're laying the foundation for changes that would be very difficult to track and maybe impossible to reverse. So we're really playing with fire here. We're playing with a new technology. Many of the most key assumptions that were used as the basis for safety claims have been overturned. In fact, many people describe that the whole science behind genetically engineered foods is about 40 years old. And this new information about the fact that genes can transfer to gut bacteria or into internal organs, this is very serious. And it means that we're exposing this population now to something which, even if people stop eating genetically engineered foods, there might be this continued residual problem inside their guts and inside their bodies as a result of continuously eating it for so many years. It's hard to say because there hasn't been any studies.
Well, now, of course, what about the products that we're getting now? We know we're getting genetically engineered soybeans and potatoes. And what about corn? What about tomatoes? What about other products? What really is genetically engineered today? And, of course, we're getting the milk coming from genetically from cows that are given this this growth hormone.
Well, there is the soybeans that are genetically engineered not to die when sprayed with herbicide, and it's interesting that soon after those soybeans were introduced to the UK, soy allergies skyrocketed by 50%. The potato was taken off the market because of consumer concerns. McDonald's and Burger King and Pringles said they wouldn't buy it, and so the potato producers wouldn't grow it, and so that's been taken off the market. About 40% of the corn in the United States is genetically engineered. Most of that goes to feed hogs and other livestock. But then we
end up eating the hogs and the livestock.
Yes. And also we eat the high fructose corn syrup and the corn oil and the corn flour. And also about 3-5% of corn on the cob is genetically engineered. And a lot of that corn produces its own pesticide. And it's interesting that a study done in the Philippines, not yet published, showed that 39 Filipinos living next to one of these cornfields that produced its own pesticide developed skin, respiratory, and intestinal reactions and fever while the corn was pollinating. We also have cotton that's genetically engineered, and we eat cottonseed oil. And there's also canola that's genetically engineered, and we also eat canola oil. Now, the other three food crops are Hawaiian papaya, and a little bit of zucchini and crookneck squash. There's also Quest brand tobacco. Now, that doesn't count the numerous experiments that are going on around the country with not yet approved genetically modified foodstuffs, where it could possibly be cross-pollinating and spreading into the environment, even if the foods aren't eventually approved.
Well, we know a lot of the genetically engineered crops are grown down in Costa Rica, apparently, and then they ship the seeds in here. Are they growing the seeds here in the United States as well?
Oh, yeah. The seeds are growing here, and also in Hawaii there's a lot of experiments going on. I should also add that there used to be a genetically modified tomato, and this tomato is, in my mind, infamous. It was the one that was fed to rats, and the rats developed stomach lesions, and 7 out of 40 died within 2 weeks, and the FDA approved the tomato.
The FDA approved the tomato because they didn't all die? What was the rationale for that?
Well, it turns out that the scientists who were looking at the study, they may have even missed the fact that some rats were dead because there was like a footnote, and you had to look in the back, and it said rats died and they were replaced.
Rats died and they were replaced. That makes you feel real good about the FDA studies, doesn't it?
True. But then, I mean, it wasn't done by the FDA. It was just reviewed by the FDA. And the FDA scientist who did the review said that it does not show a reasonable certainty of no harm and that there are unanswered questions regarding safety with respect to this bleeding stomachs. And in spite of their concerns, the FDA superiors approved it. Now, I want to make it clear. I say the FDA scientists reviewed the details of this feeding study. That was it remains unprecedented because companies do not have to give the FDA any information to have the FDA approve their genetically modified food. The FDA requires nothing on a mandatory basis. And so companies, except for this one tomato company, they typically just give a summary data of whatever they want to give. And if the FDA asks for more information, they're typically ignored, because the FDA has set up a situation where they don't have any real regulations going on.
In other words, they are certainly they're looking forward to a good golden parachute, a good retirement, working for one of these companies, and they're not protecting the American people. You know, we often hear it said, well, if we didn't have the FDA, who would regulate these things? Who would protect the public? How would you respond to that?
Well, the thing is, I mean, there are certainly ways to regulate and protect, but I don't think the FDA has come up with the proper formula. I mean, most people don't realize that the FDA does not do the studies themselves. What they do, even with drugs, is they ask the makers of the drug themselves to do the studies and then turn over the reports to the FDA. Now, there are many, many incidences where you look at the difference between industry-funded studies and independently-funded studies, and there's an incredible bias towards the industry-funded studies being showing safer drugs. Take, for example, aspartame, which was originally developed as a drug, and then because it was sweet, they sold it as a sweetener. Many people are concerned about potential health dangers associated with aspartame. In fact, half of the studies done in over a 10-year period were done by independent scientists, and all of them raised questions. Some even raised the question about the possibility of producing brain tumors. But all of the industry-sponsored studies raised no questions. So right now we're in a situation where the FDA's clients, which are the drug companies and the biotech companies, do their own research, and we are in a situation where even after their so-called rigorous multi-million dollar drug review, the General Accounting Office found that in over a long period of time, more than half the drugs had to be taken off the market or had made major label changes due to missed safety issues.
And, of course, the trouble is how many people are going to die. If the latest study is right on Vioxx, between 88,000 and 139,000 people will die. And who's going to be held responsible? Well, certainly not the FDA officials. And now they're retired. Of course, a lot of them have comfortable jobs working for the very drug companies and other companies that they were, of course, regulating. Let's go quickly to Roger. Roger, I have a quick question have to do with this.
Yeah, I had several, if you please.
No, just one question, because I don't want to interrupt what we're doing, but do you have one quick question?
Yeah, you kind of left it buried in the break, the response to the company agreed to change the label on their milk carton to read.
All right, do you want to...
Oh, yes. Well, I did mention that it was that there's no difference between the milk from cows treated with RBGH and those not treated. This was the sentence written by Monsanto's former outside attorney who became the chief policy advisor, policymaker at the FDA.
Now, is he still there, or has he gone back to work for Monsanto?
What happened was he went to the USDA to work on biotech issues and then became vice president for Monsanto, and now he calls himself an environmentalist, I think, and he's doing some studies for the, quote, independent Pew initiative on biotechnology.
Okay, does that answer your question, Roger? Yeah,
well, that sounds like the exact same line those, was it two Fox Network reporters got fired over because they refused to follow through with Monsanto lawyer-recommended lies?
Very good point. I'll pick that up.
Okay, thanks, Roger. And what was the story about the Fox reporters who got fired?
Okay, we talked about the fact that just before this incriminating four-part news series was to air, Fox received a threatening letter from Monsanto's attorney. Then they asked the station to hold off on the airing of the four-part series and to review it. The station manager reviewed it and said it was fine. They rescheduled it. Then another letter arrived, this time promising dire consequences if it were to run. They pulled it again, and according to the reporters, they were offered hush money to go away and never speak about it again, and they refused. And so then they were led on a six-month adventure in rewriting this script 83 times. And they were advised by the lawyers each time, making it less and less controversial. And then they were asked to say that the milk was completely the same. And they said that's not true. Even the Monsanto's own research says it's not the same. And they refused to say that sentence, and they were fired. And they sued Fox affiliate for using the whistleblower laws. Now, initially, the jury awarded Jane Akrey, one of these two, $425,000, saying that she was fired because she was either threatening to or about to disclose that they were breaking the law. But Fox appealed and won. And the reason why Fox won was because the appeals court said it's not against the law to lie on television, and that means the whistleblower laws do not protect the employees, because the whistleblower laws are for those threatening to disclose breaking of a law. So now these whistleblowers have to pay part of the legal fees of the Fox, which is close to $200,000.
Well, you know, the incredible things are going on, ladies and gentlemen. And the fact you're not hearing about this from the major media is simply a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. And, I mean, the animals have died, the people are getting ill, and then, of course, we have no idea why these things are happening now. You know, certainly we're trying to dump these products, I know, in Africa. The Africans don't want our genetically modified crops over there. What's happening in Africa when we're trying to give them these large supplies of genetically modified corn, for instance?
And that's a very serious problem, because in the United States we only eat 3 to 5% of corn in our caloric intake, but when it's given to Africans as food aid, they'll eat 90% of their caloric intake is corn. So imagine the corn that produces its own pesticide being given to people who already have immune damage and a compromised digestive system. When that same pesticide was given to mice, it caused an immune response equal to cholera toxin. It caused abnormal and excessive cell growth and increased susceptibility to allergies. And so it was offered to southern African nations when they were facing a famine. It was sent by the United States, and they refused. They said, "We don't want this. Please send us non-genetically engineered corn." And the U.S. refused and said, "Eat it or die." So, well, they didn't say it that way, but they implied. So, some of the countries said, okay, we'll take the corn if you mill it into flour, so at least our farmers won't replant it and won't contaminate our corn varieties. Again, the U.S. refused, and the South African nation intervened and milled it. But Zambia refused altogether. They had some scientists that actually went to the U.S. and went to Europe and started investigating and realized that there was not enough evidence to vouchsafe for the safety of these foods, and so they refused it altogether and were able to feed their nation with other means. Angola and Sudan also wanted to reject genetically modified food aid and were forced by the United States to take it. So there's a big global war going on in terms of food aid and in terms of using trade agreements to try and force these foods down people's throats.
But why would you try to force a country to take a type of corn, especially knowing that, you know, this would have disastrous effects on the population, and yet, of course, faced with famine or eating it, they'd probably eat it, and they may very well be incapacitated or die as a result of it. Certainly, did the animals die when they ate large amounts of it?
Well, first of all, I don't want to give the impression that these things are ultimately lethal and can cause immediate death. I don't believe that the State Department believes that they're going to cause death when they you know, try and promote genetically engineered crops.
But I mean, didn't the animals die when they ate it?
Well, let me tell you what the research. There's not a lot of research, but here's what we do know. We know that twice the number of chickens died when fed genetically modified corn. We know that when rats were fed genetically modified corn, they had problems in the development of their blood cells and their kidneys and extra blood sugar levels. We know that 12 cows mysteriously died in Germany when being fed only a genetically modified corn variety. I've interviewed about 3 out of about 25 farmers in the Midwest who report that when they fed genetically modified corn to their pigs, the pigs had trouble getting pregnant. They either had false pregnancies or gave birth to bags of water, or even cows had problems or gave birth to too many twins. So there's anecdotal stories. There's theoretical reasons why these things could be causing problems. There's evidence that these things might cause allergies and reasons why that's the case. But there is not a smoking gun to say that this particular genetically modified corn creates this particular problem in a human being, because there hasn't been really a lot of studies on it. I mean, they've been incredibly successful in preventing following up on these studies.
But you would think before they would give it to entire populations, they would do some limited studies to make sure it did not produce illness in human beings.
Well,
I mean, that would be the logical thing if you really were concerned about human life.
Well, they've done very limited studies, and their claims are really obsolete and ridiculous. I mean, some of the things, like we talked about this earlier, when you put a gene into another DNA, you can cause all sorts of changes in the DNA, which can cause all sorts of potential toxins or allergens to end up inside the crop. So how do they test it? They don't even use the crop in some cases to test it. What they do is they'll create the intended protein that the gene is supposed to create, and they'll make it out of bacteria. So instead of feeding the animals the corn, they're isolating one little ingredient and feeding it to animals. It's not even an ingredient created by the corn. So they get around, I mean, I'm being a little technical here, but basically if you analyze a lot of the research that's done, it seems to be rigged to avoid finding problems. They'll dilute the soybeans 10 to 1 before feeding them to animals. They'll use mature animals instead of young ones. They'll omit information entirely or distort the results and give conclusions that weren't supported by the text. In one case, milk products were pasteurized 120 times longer than normal to try and destroy a hormone.
Well, as the old adage goes, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. And when you begin to utilize science to come up with a conclusion that you want, and when you have the people who are going to make an awful lot of money, we're talking about billions of dollars, you know, doing the scientific studies, and the FDA is not, you know, doing parallel studies to make sure it's honest, when there are no independent studies to make sure these things are safe for humans to eat, we really have to be concerned, ladies and gentlemen. And I would like to suggest that this is a very, very serious problem. And certainly if the media will not cover it, who's going to? And if not now, when? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening has been Jeffrey Smith, and of course we're talking about his book, Seeds of Deception. Jeffrey, what sort of response are you getting as you go around America with this message? And I know you've been on a number of radio programs. Are you still getting a lot of calls? Are you getting any criticism for putting the information out? How's the book moving?
Well, the book is the number one critical book on GMOs in the world. It's going to be out in about 7 languages by next year. I've traveled to 16 countries, 140 cities in the last year and a half, and it's having a very big impact. In fact, many people who are campaigners around the world describe it as the Bible of the movement because it makes it clear. It sort of opens Pandora's box and shows clearly where the flaws are in the technology. But it does it in a way that people like to read it, because I wrote it. I have a background in like storytelling and marketing and communications. So I wrote it as a series of stories, and I wrote it like the scientist in Berkeley who claims a senior Mexican government official threatened him and implied, "We know where your children go to school," trying to get him not to publish incriminating research about the attempted briberies and the burglaries and the ways that about 100 people died and 5 to 10,000 fell sick from a mysterious deadly epidemic which was traced to a genetically modified food supplement. So it's turned out that it's changing public policy in many areas. There's many legislators in Vermont who's read it, and now there's some legislation moving forward in Vermont very well. So it was also used a lot in the campaigns in California, where they banned the planting of genetically modified crops in 2 counties as a result of ballot initiatives, and another county as a result of supervisor ordinance. So there's a lot of groundswell around the world and around the country to try and stop genetically engineered foods in any way that we can. And one of the things that I do in my book that I make very clear is that there are things people can do, not only to help with the basic fight, but most importantly, to protect ourselves from eating it. And I describe in detail in a whole chapter how people can avoid eating genetically engineered foods.
All right, fine. Well, I want to thank you so very much, not only for being our guest, but for writing the book, and I hope we can get you onto some of our other programs. We actually have 4 different audiences, and this is just the second one you've talked to, but I think it's such an important subject. Our guest this evening has been Jeffrey Smith, his book Seeds of Deception, and when we get back from the break, we're going to tell you how you can get the book. It's available through Radio Liberty, and I think it's really one of the most important books we do carry, because these genetically altered foods are every place. It's in the milk you're getting. God bless you, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and I didn't want any real callers this evening because I wanted you to hear this story in its entirety. I think this is a very important book. We are under attack from all sides, and you've heard our programs on fluoride. I've talked to a professor up at the University of Toronto, and he is, of course, used to be a great supporter of fluoride, and then when he began to analyze it, he realized, of course, we were poisoning our children, we were poisoning our adults, and of course, when he came out, out and tried to get the information out, he was threatened. This is going on all across the world today. When people speak out and they're in a vulnerable position working for government, working for universities, why, they are threatened. Their lives are threatened. And, well, I think you need to get this book, Seeds of Deception. Well written, very well done, very authoritative. I think it's entirely valid. Ladies and gentlemen, we're being poisoned. There really are evil and wicked people out there. Of course, most people find it difficult to believe that anything could be that terrible, that anybody would intentionally do this. They're just trying to make money, and I'm sure some of them are trying to make money. But some of them know exactly what they're doing, ladies and gentlemen, because there are too many people in the world that like to get the world population down to about 500 million. How are they going to do that? Why this would be a very effective means is, well, it was the aspartame, which is NutraSweet, which they're poisoning us with, and the mercury that they put in the vaccines. Have you ever wondered why they want everybody to get the vaccines when it's not even for the organism that is involved? Why they want to give it to the older people when so many of the older people will take the influenza vaccine and they'll get sick? Why do they want to give it to six-month-old children when, according to Dr. Fudenberg, who is the dean of vaccinologists in the world today, with over 850 peer-reviewed articles, and he points out that if you take the influenza vaccine, you're over between 60 and 65, and you take the influenza vaccine 3 to 4 shots over a 5-year period, 10 years down the line, 1,000% increase in Alzheimer's disease. They know that, ladies and gentlemen. That's Dr. Fudenberg's work. If you'd like a copy of his work, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a copy of his abstract off of his page, but you really need to seriously consider getting the book, Seeds of Deception. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV, war. Because we are at war, your family, your freedom, your future are under attack today, and not by the Islamic terrorists, but from within. And if you haven't got our 4 tapes out on water fluoridation, just on fluoridation, our 4 tapes out on aspartame, our 4 tapes out on mercury, you need to get these. You need to get our 4 tape set on genocide and population control. You need to get all of these tape sets, and you need to listen to them. You need to copy them, and you have our permission to copy them and disseminate them. You really ought to get copies of this evening's program with Jeffrey. And, of course, we'll probably be putting together a 4 tape set on genetically modified food. It's an amazing, amazing story. But, of course, you're not going to get this from Dan Rather because he's retiring. Or from Tom Brokaw, because he's retiring, but you're not going to get it from Jane Pauley or from any of the others, because if they want to keep their job, they're not going to tell you the truth. Their purpose is not to tell you the truth or reveal the truth. The purpose of the major media is to conceal the truth. The media is controlled, and if you doubt that, you need to get the book, which we're carrying now. It's written by a far-left winger, but it's absolutely correct. It's called The New Media Monopoly, pointing out that 5 mega corporations dominate almost all of the major media in America today and determine what most people hear, what they read, and what they see, and ultimately what they believe. So we're in real trouble. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927, the book Seeds of Deception, and you probably would want to get not only the book, but the audio tape program. Audio tape of this program, Pray for America, Pray for Revival, and of course remember to please to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here, not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And you're welcome to call this hour if you have a question or comment. We have with us this evening Ron Brown, and Ron is a supporter of Radio Liberty, and he helps us stay on the air. He also sells gold and silver coins. I've asked him to be on tonight because I have a feeling of we're in real trouble economically as a nation. Of course, I believe our major problem is we as a nation have turned against God, and God brings judgment in many ways upon nations. He brings plagues on the nations. He involves them in wars. But, of course, one of the most effective means of destroying a nation is destroying the foundation of its economic system. Now, down through the ages, why societies have had gold-backed currencies, and those that have had gold-backed currencies have survived. And you go back and study what happened in ancient Rome. And, of course, about 300 A.D., why Diocletian, corrupting the monetary supply of Rome, divided the Roman Empire into two divisions. One in the west and one in the east. And, of course, he kept creating more money to finance the military adventures of Rome. And, of course, this began to corrupt the monetary supply. Rampant inflation took hold. Diocletian had to declare wage and price controls. And it was a capital offense if you sold something for more than you should or you bought something for more than you should. And even that, of course, didn't work. And so eventually, of course, the Diocletian retired and went to raising cabbages and, of course, left the western part of Rome, of course, progressively degenerating until it eventually collapsed in 475 A.D. But the eastern half of the empire went to a gold-backed currency, a gold dinar, and lasted for 1,000 years. It lasted for 1,000 years because it had a stable currency. Well, America had a stable currency up until really about 1935, and even though we had the central bank, the Federal Reserve System, which incidentally the Federal Reserve is no more a part of government than Federal Express is, the Federal Reserve is a privately owned central bank owned by the central bankers, and of course they run our economy and determine what happens to our economy, just as the central banks of every other country are privately owned, and it is the bankers there that tell the government what to do, not the government telling the bankers what to do under any circumstances. Why, we've been on a fiat money system since really domestically 1935, and then of course in 1971, August 15th, why Richard Nixon took the whole world off of a gold-backed currency, and of course by 1980 we were in runaway inflation. They had to raise the interest rates up and crush the economy, and they did get things back at least running. And but we are now 25 years later, and it was just a week ago, last Friday, when a man named Stephen Roach, R-O-A-C-H, who's the chief economist for Morgan Stanley, held a private briefing, and of course, talking to economists and financial leaders throughout the world, he said there's a 90% chance that the United States will go through a financial Armageddon. And of course, his remarks were supposed to have been very private. Somebody got a text of it, put it up on the internet. Interesting study. I tried to find it on the internet. Stephen Roach, Financial Armageddon. They buried it very well. The last thing they want the American people to know is what may lay ahead in the near future. Well, Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And Ron, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh,
Always a pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Well, now, of course, you are following along pretty well what's taking place economically in our country and throughout the world. Why don't you give our listeners your view of what's happening and how this whole scenario is unfolding?
Well, when I came on tonight, I wanted to kind of do an overview of how we got to where we are, and you just did a pretty good job of that. But I really believe, Dr. Stan, that this whole financial system, not of just the U.S., but of the whole world, because we've literally sucked the whole world into this fractional reserve banking system, is approaching critical mass. And that is all the bad investments and all the debt structure that's been built over the last, 60, 70 years are reaching a point where it's just totally becoming unsustainable. And all the tricks and all the efforts of the bankers to put off the day of reckoning have just made matters worse for the last 20 years, and now it's just reaching a point where I really believe nothing they can do will stop this thing from unraveling. And as you know, in just the past few months, it's starting to accelerate. The deficits that you talk about all the time just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and the flight out of the dollar from foreign interest is accelerating. In fact, they're buying less and less of our debt every month, which means someone else has to monetize that debt or print the money to buy that debt. And so we're just in a jam where we have to keep the printing press running faster and faster and faster. The system has literally become a Ponzi scheme, because the one thing you can't do is allow the amount of money in circulation to ever contract, because then you don't have the money to keep paying the interest on this ever-increasing debt structure. And that's the point we're reaching.
And I think with Rio, what's so important is to realize that this has happened dozens and dozens of times out through history. I mean, you can go back and you can study what happened in France in the early 1700s when a Scotsman named John Law convinced the King of England that he could produce prosperity by simply printing paper money. And of course, backed by the income of the French government and by the property that the king owned, and they could produce prosperity by printing money, and it worked very well for a short period of time. And then, of course, as the value of the currency began to decline, well, they had to print more money, and then they had to print more money, and before long, the whole economic system of France collapsed, because with nothing behind the paper money, how do you keep politicians from spending money, and of course, the people will accept it, and then, of course, they'll reject it when they realize it doesn't have any value, it has no gold or silver behind it, and no restraint on the politicians. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown, who certainly is one of our supporters, and he sells gold and silver, and Ron was saying that he is concerned that the foreigners are now have slowed down buying of the American debt. You know, it used to be said, the economist said, why, you don't have to worry about the national debt because we owe it to ourselves. So as long as we owe the debt to ourselves, you don't have to worry how large the debt is. Well, we no longer owe the debt to ourselves. We owe it to foreign countries, and foreigners own over $2 trillion of the United States debt. They are buying debt at the rate of about $2 billion a day. At least they have been until recently. But with a declining dollar, why would you want to buy bonds that were secured by a dollar that is collapsing? So foreign governments are beginning to cut back. China is beginning to cut back on buying our debt. Japan is beginning to cut back on buying our debt because they've been impoverishing their people so that we could keep living high on the hog and buying things and buying and buying. And, of course, Germany is beginning to cut back on buying our debt. So right now, of course, the Federal Reserve is having to actually print money to buy the debt to keep this whole house of cards alive. But that becomes highly inflationary. And, of course, inflation means that you have excess money. And, of course, as people begin then to doubt the stability of the American dollar, then they will want to get out of the dollar. And, of course, Ron, what have you heard about what's happening over in China as far as the average Chinese? Of course, in the past, they've always wanted to have dollars because they had a permanency, they had a stability of the value of the dollar. The dollar was very high in value, and now it's gone down over 30% in the last, maybe a year, year and a half or so. And there's talk now by members of the Bilderbergers publicly talking about another 50 5% drop, that is 5-0% drop in the value of the dollar. This just came out this last week. What are the Chinese, the average person in China, doing as far as their holdings of dollars?
You know, for years under communism, the Chinese people were in abstract poverty, so they couldn't have bought gold if they wanted to because they didn't have any wealth. But over the last 20 years, as you've discussed many times, we've been sending all of our plants and our technology over to China to take advantage of the slave labor. You know, you can pay a Chinese peasant 50 cents a day instead of $100 a day that you get over here, then it makes profit, things a lot more profitable. So our corporate structure has sent all of their plants overseas, and now those peasants are starting to earn a living. And as they grow in prosperity, then they have the excess funds to start buying gold and silver. And, of course, the Chinese, historically, throughout all history, have always distrusted paper money, because the origin of paper money goes back to China thousands of years ago. And they've always loved gold and silver. So, yeah, over the last 2 years or so, the Chinese people are starting to buy more and more gold progressively, and it's accelerating as they become more profitable.
And really what's so interesting, there's been an article up on Jeff Rentz's website that the Chinese people are getting out of dollars. In other words, they don't want to hold dollars anymore. They want to either hold Chinese currency or they want to hold gold, but they do not want the dollar. So the average Chinese person is getting out of the dollar. Now, of course, the countries throughout the world, I mean, they hold all of this debt, many of the reserves, 70 or 80% of the reserves that they have to defend their own currency are in American dollars. But that dollar is already down 30%, so they've lost 30% of the wealth that they've accumulated, and they're talking another 50% drop in the value. Maybe it'll only be 40%, or maybe it'll be 60%. 60% and 30%, well, that doesn't leave much left over as far as the value of the dollar. And this is what they're thinking throughout the world. They want something that will be stable, like at least like the euro, which has some gold backing, and they're of course protecting their currency over there, and they're raising their interest rates, even though it's going to hurt their economy. Why the German central bank, and of course the European central bank, raising interest rates because the one thing they fear is the destruction of their currency. Whereas of course even Alan Greenspan recently, I gave a talk about 2 weeks ago, we talked about how other countries are not going to continue indefinitely funding our debt. Today, we are totally dependent on other countries to keep this house of cards, which is the American economic system, which is built upon a currency that has nothing behind it other than faith in the integrity of a government that lies. When this whole house of cards comes tumbling down, the people who are tied into investments and money certainly could lose everything, couldn't they, Ron?
Absolutely. You know, it might be helpful to just step back and see how all this the last 20 years was made possible. You know, if you think back to 1982, the U.S. had gone through an inflationary blow-off. That's when gold hit $850 and silver was at $50. And if you recall, interest rates were 21.5%, and the bond market was collapsing. The dollar was in a shambles. And I think everyone's heard the old saying that when America catches a cold, the rest of the world gets pneumonia. So if the U.S. was in deep trouble in the early 80s, then the rest of the world was in more serious trouble. So in 1982 is when President Reagan came out and he basically gave a speech that says, "Damn the torpedoes, folks. We're not going to go into a deflationary depression. We're going to run the printing press and we're going to create prosperity." And as we started to run the printing press and we had money to buy things, the rest of the world naturally wanted to sell to us, and they were all competing for the U.S. trade dollar. So what they all were doing, the central banks I'm talking about of each nation, were orchestrating their currencies lower versus the dollar so that the dollar would buy more of their product, or their products would be more attractive to the U.S. consumer. An example I give is Japan wanted to sell Hondas, and they wanted the Hondas to be more attractive to the American consumer than Buicks. And by the way, Germany wanted to sell too, so they had to make their product more attractive than Hondas or Buicks. So what they were all doing is, how do you make your currency cheaper versus the dollar, you simply print your money and use that money to buy U.S. dollars. But you don't buy dollars, you buy dollar instruments. So, in effect, the foreigners were buying U.S. Treasury bonds, which in effect means that the foreigners have been financing our deficits for all these years, and that the dollar kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger as everyone scrambled to buy more dollars, gave us the euphoric feeling in America that we were King Kong. The dollar was getting stronger every year. The foreigners who were buying those dollars were happy because the dollar was rising in value. So it was a fun game for 20 years, but like all artificial markets, it had to come to an end. Of course, in what year 2000 is when the dot-com bubble burst and the dollar started down. So now the other shoe is about to drop. All those foreign goods we were buying for cheaper, and therefore people perceive no inflation, are starting to go up in price. Look at the cost of oil, for example, as the dollar drops in value against the currencies of the world.
And I think this is really the frightening thing, is that, you know, as our currency continues to fall, why I think more and more countries are going to want to get out of the dollar. And, of course, the fear is that the dollar will lose its position as the reserve currency of the world. Now, today, all oil, or almost all oil, is bought in relationship to dollars. But Russia is increasingly going to the euro. It said that one reason for the attack on Iraq was that Saddam Hussein was beginning to shift over to the euro in payment for his oil. If the world were to change to purchasing oil with the euro rather than the dollar, if the dollar were to lose its reserve status throughout the world, in other words, no longer be the reserve currency for the rest of the world, and all of these countries throughout the world that have dollars as 50 to 70 to 80% of their reserves start to unload those dollars, which are losing value, why, what impact would that have on our economy here at home? If all those dollars were suddenly thrust into the world, they were no longer being held, but were coming home here.
It's like the whole world is saying to the U.S., not only do we not want to give you $2 billion of new money every day to keep the process going, what we really want to do is trade in or cash in the chips for the dollars we've accumulated over the last 20 years. And see, all we need for them to do is stop buying the new money. And our system's in deep trouble. If they ever panic and start selling aggressively the dollars they've accumulated for 20 years, then the dollar could go into an absolute devastating collapse.
And I think this is the real fear that the people who are working behind the scenes have. Why in heaven's name would any country or any individual want to hold a dollar that its value is plunging, because you lose your purchasing power. If you hang on to it, you've got to get out of that. But what we have done over a period of years is to export our inflation to other countries. In other words, we've been printing all of this money, and of course, as long as we can get other countries to buy that and use it in their reserves, that's fine. Then the price of products at home here doesn't go up, because of course inflation is simply too much money chasing too few goods. But suddenly what happens if all of those dollars, we're talking about trillions of dollars, throughout the rest of the world, suddenly begin to flood back into the United States, buying things, buying whatever it can, just so they'll have something tangible in place of those dollars, why the whole house of cards, I fear, will come tumbling down. And I think that that is a very real fear, and I think if you read Alan Greenspan's remarks, I think you see that he sees that. I think that if you look up on the internet under Stephen Roach, or Steve Roach, R-O-A-C-H, and he is the senior economist at Morgan Stanley, but you don't have to put that in, just put down Financial Armageddon under Google and read what his remarks are. And I think that you will then perhaps share my feeling of urgency. Somebody's got to tell the American people, the average person has worked all their life to accumulate money, that everything he's worked so hard to accumulate is in danger today. And he's got to begin to reposition himself if he hopes to be able to survive what Stephen Roach refers to as the perfect storm. And, of course, Jim Poplava is called the perfect financial storm. All the various things coming together at one time, like the perfect storm we saw in that movie with George Clooney, that, of course, swamped the boat and killed all the inhabitants. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and of course we're covering some of the things we've covered before, but people really have to understand the foundation of a fiat money system. It's built entirely on debt, and I'm going to let Ron explain how this system works, how they create money out of nothing, and for the last, almost 80 years have convinced the American people that you could create money out of nothing and create prosperity. Would you like to sort of explain how this whole debt system works, Ron?
Sure. Let's just go back to the beginning of our nation and give you a little insight. If you think about it, the War of Revolutionary War was fought by the settlers trying to break away from the all-powerful tyranny of a central government, the King of England. And as they fought and gained their freedom, they had to sit down and form a government for themselves. And here you had 13 colonies, all basically unrelated, but they all distrusted big government. So they formed something called the Articles of Confederation, and they were so fearful of a powerful government that they gave it very little power, and the first currency that our country had was something called the Continental Dollar. And the Continental Dollar was, for all practical purposes, purely fiat. It was just paper money. And, of course, the demand for things and help from government, they started to print the currency very quickly, and within a matter of a few years, the old saying came, it ain't worth a continental, because the dollar was just inflated into oblivion, and that's when they had to recall and come back to a constitutional convention, and out of that constitutional convention, they described and defined the dollar as a specific amount of gold and or silver. So there was a restraint on how much paper money could be created because it had to be backed by the equivalent amount of gold. And under that system for 124 years, by 1913, from 1791 to 1913, the value of the dollar was basically stable. It would buy the same amount of loaves of bread or acres of land or whatever as it would 124 years earlier. And when you think of that in terms of today's world, you say, my goodness, a Coke, which was 3-5 cents or so 30-40 years ago, is now $1.50 to $2, whatever. So anyway, the dollar maintained its purchasing power for 124 years under the discipline of a gold standard. In 1913, of course, is when the Federal Reserve was created. Most people think it's federal. You alluded to it earlier. It's not federal at all. It's a private corporation of these international bankers who were granted by Congress. Our Congress, who abrogated their authority to control the money, they gave the ability to this private bank to create money out of nothing and loan it to the government. Now, you say, well, why would our leaders have allowed something to come into place that was so corrupt from its very origin? And I would call it just political expediency.
And maybe a few dollars exchanging hands here, there, and elsewhere. Certainly one of the major proponents of this was a man named Senator Nelson Aldrich, for whom Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller was named. And Senator Aldrich was one of the most powerful men in the Senate, and he was working hand in glove with the people from J.P. Morgan and from the other large banking companies, because this is how they were going to gain control of the money of this country. And whoever controls the printing of the money controls the nation. Doesn't matter who the politicians are. You control the money. Why, of course, anybody can be in power, but you can control them, and that's what makes the world go around. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and he's just been talking about, our currency, how, we had gold-backed currencies back in 1787, and the currency maintained its value. Things did not go up in cost over a period of 130 years, from 1787 up until 1913, when they brought in the Federal Reserve System. Well, this is a privately owned central bank, and it would create the greatest scam of all time, because it would simply, every year, it would steal 2 or 3% of the value of the American people until the dollar of 1913, I would say the present dollar is worth about 5 cents of the dollar of 1913. So they've destroyed about, now almost 95% of the purchasing value of our currency. And, of course, the average American has no idea how this has happened. It's all been by creating money out of nothing. And when you can create money out of nothing, you can get great wealth for yourself. And this is how a very, very small group of people have been able to buy up the corporations, have been able to buy up the mining, have been able to buy up the oil and the drug companies, have been able to buy up the media. Oh, yes, and buy up the politicians. We have in Washington, D.C., and many of our state capitals, the finest politicians that this fiat money system could buy. So pick up the story there, Ron.
Yeah, and the key to understand is why would the politicians back then have ever allowed this to happen? If you think about it, politicians get elected by promising the people something, and they want to promise them something for nothing. But if you're on a gold system and you have to balance the budget, if you promise one group something, you have to tax another group in order to pay for it. And so you lose the support of the people you tax, so it's a non-productive thing. Now, if you could come up with a system that allowed you to print money or promise people something for nothing, then you spend more money than you bring in taxes, but you tax the people indirectly through this inflation tax because you just monetize it through this banking system who creates money out of nothing. And what makes it even worse than just fiat system is this private bank creates money with no cost to themselves. They create it out of nothing, and they don't give it to the U.S. government. They loan it to the U.S. government, so now we have to pay interest on something they created out of nothing. Now, if you think about it, who wouldn't like to have a business where your cost of goods sold was zero and you had a constant income coming in from that? That's a pretty good system, and, of course, that's a system that the bankers who created will do everything in their power to keep in place.
And I think it's so important to understand that when you go to the bank to borrow money, let's say you want to buy a house, why, of course, you put up that house as collateral, and they make a banking entry, say, for $100,000 for that house. Now, that house then becomes the basis of this new money that's been created out of nothing, and then, of course, they charge you interest on the money they've created out of nothing to buy so you can buy the house. It's the greatest scam in the world. The average individual has never figured out how it works because it really worked very well. We've had a couple of interruptions back in 1929 when we had the Great Depression, and then, of course, the end of the 1970s, the early 1980s, when they had, of course, drive the interest rates up very high to stop the runaway inflation, which is the end product of this phony money system, this fiat money system. But, of course, they got things under control. They started growing beginning in the early 1980s. And there was a slight contraction in the early 1990s. But, of course, here we are today now, at the year 2004. We have a debt that's over $7.4 trillion, moving rapidly towards an $8 trillion debt. We have, of course, if you go into the background of what really is owed here, why it's estimated that the government is promised with Social Security and Medicare and the pensions and the government pensions and all the giveaway programs about $72 trillion. There's no way in the world they're going to be able to meet their obligations. They know that. They just don't want the American people to know that. And the politicians want to get out of office before the House of Cards comes tumbling down. But don't you worry. Social Security may be destroyed. But the politicians, they're not in Social Security. They have their own private pension fund that is invested very wisely, and they'll get their income for life and really millions of dollars that they'll get as they have, of course, betrayed the American people. And this is what the average individual doesn't know. They do not realize what's really going on behind the scenes. We have a fiat money system. People throughout the world are beginning to reject the dollar. The dollar soon, I believe, will fall as the reserve currency of the world. Trillions of dollars are going to get funneling back in here. And the value of our currency, as Stephen Roach has said, a financial Armageddon lies ahead. Where? Well, it's not too far away. I don't know when. We don't know the timing, but we know it's coming sooner or later. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and we have Tony calling from Soquel, or from Santa Cruz. He has a question for you, Ron. Tony, what was your question?
Well, there are many people who have investments in IRAs who are, they're invested in mutual funds and securities. So what kind of advice would you give them if they could, if they wanted to move their IRA into more, into a more secure type of investment like metals or coins or something? How do you do that with an IRA account if you're going to do that?
You can do it with an IRA. You can't do it with a 401k that's from a company. With an IRA, you just need to sign up as a one of your custodians. There's several companies that I'm aware of. One is American Church Trust down in Houston. Another one is Sterling Trust, I think, in Waco, where they become your custodian. Now, the problem with an IRA, you can't buy gold and store it yourself. They, the custodian, has to store it for you. But you can get out of regular stocks and so forth and put it into gold and silver and have it stored by a custodian.
Okay, does that answer your question? If you want more information, I will have Ron put out his telephone number, and I'm sure he can give you the how to get in touch with those folks down the line.
Sure.
Thank
can.
You.
Anything else, Tony?
Well, that's it. Thanks.
Okay, fine. Well, let's go to Eric, who's calling from Compton. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well as you know, all we do is put out bad news here, but someone's got to be out there on the front line saying the redcoats are coming like Paul Revere. And so if we can get people, at least some of the people who believe what we say, to begin to protect themselves, at least some people are going to survive the coming turmoil.
Dr. Stan, the truth hurts, but Christ said it'll also set you free.
Right. Amen to that.
Mr. Brown, how are you?
Just fine.
I've written down your number several times. I haven't called yet, but I would like some advice. I can retire from my job now, but I'm only 52 years old. I would like to know what advice could you give me so I could kind of set a hedge against this the collapse that I definitely believe is coming.
All right. Now, what sort of work do you do, Eric?
I work for a supermarket. I just came out of a strike a little while ago where they told me everything is going through the roof, but they told me I couldn't get a raise.
All right, fine. Well, now, but can you get your hands on your retirement funds? In other words, if you were to retire now, can you get your retirement fund in a lump sum?
No.
You can't. So it's going to have to stay in there?
Dr. Stan, I don't have one.
You don't have any retirement fund?
No. All I have is Social Security.
Okay, but of course you're not going to be able to get that to do.
Well, excuse me, I do have a retirement fund, but I can't get a lump sum. No.
Okay, so it's going to stay in there, and you can't any way direct that. You can't no way you can self direct that.
No, just I can only draw it monthly.
All right. So what's your advice to Eric?
Are you talking substantial money in that fund?
Hold that thought. This is Dr. Stan. We have Eric calling from Compton. He's 52 years old. He says he can retire, work for a supermarket. He has a pension fund, but he can't get it out. He can just get a monthly payment from that. He'll have Social Security when he gets to be 62 or 65, but he's a young man at 52. And, of course, he's wondering what he should do at this time. What are your suggestions for him?
Are you saying, is it Tony?
Eric.
Eric, I'm sorry.
Eric from Compton, right.
If you quit your job and retire, you can't get that money in a lump sum. It has to be paid to you monthly?
Yes, sir. I will inquire about that. I've never really inquired, but I think it's just monthly.
Sometimes you really want to find out if you can get that money out, because I would think my thought, and I'll see what Ron thinks, my thought would be to get that money out and put it into things that would be tied to something that is going to go up instead of down, as I think most of the stock market's going to do soon. What are your thoughts, Ron?
Well, my thought is...
Well, we've lost our callers. I'm going to ask to our producer to go ahead and get Ron Brown back on the line for us, if you wouldn't mind. And one of those gremlins came along here about that time and simply cut off our callers. But I think that Ron is going to, first of all, suggest that, you know, if there's any way you could possibly get your money out of your pension fund, you may very well lose a lot of the money that's in the pension fund. Richard Russell, who's certainly one of the great writers, he's been writing a newsletter for 40 years. I can remember when I first got started 40 years ago, Richard Russell was writing a newsletter, and he said that he really thinks that the relationship between the gold and the stock market is going to cross. He made this suggestion one time back in the 1970s, and sure enough, the stock market dropped to about 1,000, and the price of gold hit almost 1,000. So they did cross. At that time, he thinks the price of gold and the stock market are going to cross again. He thinks the market's going to fall, perhaps to 3,000. He thinks that gold is going to go up to 3,000. So, now I'm not saying he's right, but he's a pretty smart fellow. He's a lot smarter than I am. And so, he is thinking that people would be well to get out of the stock market and position themselves for a financial Armageddon. That's not his term, that's Stephen Roach's term, but we're trying to get Ron back on the line, and I hope Eric is still listening. In fact, if Eric would like to call in again, we did have an electronic glitch, and so we didn't mean to cut him off, but if Eric is out there and he's listening, or if he'd like to call it again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we're doing our best to get Ron Brown back on the line to get his thoughts, because I think this is a problem that many people are going to face, and I think that people who are wise right now are going to begin to position themselves for some very, very difficult times. And let's just see who we have on line one. Who do we have on line one now?
This is Eric.
Eric, okay, that's Eric. We got Eric back from Compton, and we've got Ron Brown back on the line. So, we lost Eric. I'm sorry, Eric, I pushed the wrong button. So give us a call again. Anyway, Ron, how would you address Eric's concerns? Because he's a young man. He's, he's still relatively young. He's got another 10 years. He could work, but of course he could always quit his job, get his pension, and get himself another job. But I think that the jobs may be hard to get in the future. I would certainly like to know that I would have a steady income.
Yeah, I would hesitate to tell one to quit a job to get their retirement out at that age. If they were 62 or 63 and they had substantial money in that fund, then it might be worth it to retire just to protect that savings, because the savings is going to be wiped out, I'm afraid, over the next 2, 3, 4 years as the dollar accelerates to the downside.
Okay, so, well, what happens if he could get the money out? It was a sizable sum. Let's say it's a couple of $100,000 that he could lay his hands on. Of course, he'd have to retire to do that. He probably could get a job working for somebody else. Would it be worthwhile to do that, to actually get access to that fund and get it invested into something that would be solvent, rather than take the possibility of seeing the pension fund that he's worked for so many years wiped out in value?
Absolutely. You know, if it's a substantial amount of money and he can get another job, and it sounds like if you're in that line of business, there are other places you could get a job, even if you might get paid a little less because you have to start back, you know, from scratch. But if you've got substantial money, the main thing is to protect that savings. You know, if you're losing 5 to 10% of your purchasing power per year, if it's $200,000 in savings, that's a lot of money to give up. So,
well, yeah, I remember, of course, what happened during the Great Depression. You know, the people who bought in 1929, 1930, 1931, there was a bear rally at that time. But, you know, of course, then the market really crashed. From the early 30s, I think it was to the late mid-50s or early 60s before it got back, the market got back to where it was in 1929 and 1930, 31. Do you remember what those figures were?
Oh, the market lost something like 95% of its value. And you say, well, it came back. Well, did it really? You know, a lot of the companies that were traded back then were totally belly up, so you lost everything. Just as a lot of people lost everything they had in Enron and some of these other companies that went broke during the dot-com bubble burst, you know, just a few years back. So, yeah, it's... And plus, you know, I really believe that at this cycle, you know, in the 30s, you had the first cycle of this fiat money system. But as we know, all fiat systems ultimately are totally destroyed. My guess is the dollar as we know it is on its last legs. That when we go through this cycle, the dollar will be totally redefined as something totally new. And I'm afraid it won't even be a sovereign currency. I'm afraid it'll be some type of international currency, which, in effect, would destroy our national sovereignty as a nation.
Well, I really think that that's really what the plan is. If they destroy our currency, then they'll be able to get us to go into one of these, maybe the uniting all of the Western Hemisphere or something like that. They may call it a dollar, but it won't be the old dollar at all. It'll be a new currency. And eventually, of course, the real plan is to go into a one-world currency, a one-world government, and a one world religion, and of course to destroy traditional Christianity. So there, of course, Eric, if you're still out there listening, I'm surprised. Sorry we cut you off the second time there. Didn't do it on purpose. You want to call back in again, or if anybody else is out there in the listening audience, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Ron, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? You sell gold and silver, and of course you've put out what I think is an excellent report going into much of what we've talked about tonight. How can people get in touch with you, get that report, and of course, what will they learn when they do it? And then we'll ask you to tell us what you think people should be doing to position themselves.
Well, I've been in the business of selling gold and silver since 1979, and it took me, just to give you a little background, I'd graduated from LSU back in 66, and I had got an MBA, so I'd learned all this Keynesian nonsense. You know, just as a side note, I remember when I was taking my first course in monetary theory, that would have been in 1963, right. I remember that's when they teach about the Federal Reserve System and how it works and how you have these 12 district governors and they meet every 6 weeks and they decide what interest rates are going to be and the discount rate and all this stuff, you know. And I remember I used to have this recurring dream throughout that whole semester and actually for 10 years afterwards. And in this dream, there would be this elaborate boardroom with all in wood panel and around this gigantic conference table were these 12 district governors. And in my dream, they were all dressed in black tux and tails. And they're all sitting up prim and proper like they're doing everything the way it should be. And then in my dream, they would always end up having a white cowboy hat on, and I would wake up in a shock. And I'd say, what is wrong with this picture? I'm supposed to believe that these gentlemen sit there in private, we don't even know what they're doing, and they make decisions that affect our very livelihood, and we're supposed to be, there's no special interest or corruption that goes into this system. And so I really believe it was the Spirit, Holy Spirit, telling me way back when this is a bunch of nonsense and trying. But for 12 years I would have this dream, but I'd learned all this nonsense, and who was I to question this college professor who was my little god at the time? So it amazes me. It took me 12 years to really realize what was happening to the system and how it was corrupt. And from that point forward I had to get into the gold business, and I've been doing it since 1979.
Well, how can people get in touch with you and get that report, and what does the report cover?
Okay, they want to report. It's 1-800-595-0561. That's 1-800-595-0561. And I've written several reports, but the one that you were referring to was one I wrote back in March, and it's talking about the bullish case for silver. What I try to do is simply go into the monetary system, explain how the whole debt system is becoming unsustainable, it's about to collapse, and that as people lose confidence in that system, they're going to look to the refuge of gold, silver, or something to protect themselves from the devaluation of the dollar, which is, of course, what we've been talking about all night. So I'm just trying to explain to people in simple layman-like terms, so you don't have to be an economist to understand what's going on. It's really very simple once you grasp the concept. And just to show people how they can protect themselves by buying gold and silver, because that gets you out of the system of devaluing currencies.
And I think that people have to understand that there's nothing new under the sun. They devalued the value of the coinage back in ancient Greece and the society collapsed. They destroyed the value of the coinage in ancient Rome, and the society collapsed. We've seen this happen over and over again. Certainly France was on the basis of collapse in the early 1700s when John Law, we saw the collapse of the continental dollar. Then, of course, in 1789, they had a revolt in France, the French Revolution, and of course they came up with a wonderful idea. They would simply print money backed by the value of the property they'd seized from the church and backed by the income of the revolutionary government. This was a solidly backed currency. It was backed by the faith in the French government. And of course what happened is the politicians began giving more and more to the people, and eventually why they had to print more and more money, and the value of the money went down, and they had to print more and more money. We have a wonderful book called Fiat Money Inflation in France that tells the story of what happened, the breakdown in morality associated with the artificial affluence, and eventually the collapse of the society and the establishment of a dictatorship. The dictator's name was Napoleon Bonaparte. And of course you can see this same cycle over and over and over again. And of course we, if you get my October newsletter, we tell you the story of the First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States, and of course how the central banks work in concert. And we'd be glad to send you a free copy of the October newsletter if you simply call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Ron, one of the things that really concerns me is most Americans are head over heel in debt. They not only are making massive payments or very large payments on their houses, and especially the people who have been foolish enough to get these adjustable rate mortgages, the so-called ARM mortgages, and they're being told, oh, go ahead and get an adjustable rate mortgage. It's so much lower than, of course, the mortgage you'd get if you had to pay regular rates. Everybody thinks they're going to be able to beat the system. Do you think they can beat the system?
No, it's an illusion of prosperity. As our jobs are sent overseas and people are making less money, they offset that by saying, come in and refinance your house, not at 8%, but let's do it at 5%. And that saves you $300 or $400 or $1,000 a month, depending on the mortgage size. So you have this illusion that you have more money. The reality is you're going deeper and deeper into debt. And, of course, part of the scam is that they keep pumping money into the system, creating more and more higher prices. So if you own real estate and the house is going up in value, you think you're getting richer and richer and richer. In reality, it's just bogus money because the purchasing power is less and less and less. So your true wealth is probably dropping because, one, you're going into debt, and, two, even though you have more dollars in your pocket, they're buying less and less and less. I really believe the other shoe is about to drop, because for 20 years the dollar was stronger, and now that artificial thing is over and the dollar is losing purchasing power against the rest of the world. So all those things that we were buying for cheaper and cheaper and cheaper for 20 years are now going up and up in price, even as we lose our jobs and are making less money. So it's the treadmill is going faster than the average person right now.
And I think that the great tragedy is the average individual really doesn't understand what's going on behind the scenes. And, of course, nobody's going to tell them that we're facing a financial Armageddon. And if they don't get the house of cards in order, they may very well lose everything, their annuities, their bonds, their CDs, their bank deposits. All of these things are in jeopardy because the smart money, I mean, Warren Buffett's investing overseas, and he's shorted the American dollar. In other words, he thinks the dollar is going to fall, and he's made a lot of money because it's been falling recently, and Warren Buffett's a very smart man. George Soros is investing overseas. They're not investing in American dollars. But, of course, the last thing that they want is for the American people really to see what's happening. Well, we've got Roger calling from Allentown. Roger, you have a quick question?
Yeah, just a quick one. My question, Ron, is do you see much potential, now it would of course be true even if it wasn't a biblical proverb that the borrower is servant to the lender, I'm asking, do you see much blackmail potential, not just even with commie China, but principally even if their percentage of holdings of those T-bills are relatively small, that would the threat of withdrawing or cashing those T-bills could be used to effectively blackmail us.
Did you say China?
Yeah.
Or any foreigner? Yes, I definitely think that's true. We have to give in to keep them from collapsing our system. Now, the one thing that keeps that from happening overnight is the simple fact that the whole world still depends on us. They still need to trade with us. Plus, they own so many of our dollars that if they just collapse the system overnight, then no one gains. It takes the whole world into a black hole. So they kind of have to play along for a while. But you can see it that all the nations of the world, in my opinion, are jockeying for position to, one, try to disengage from their over-dependence on American markets. And as we transfer all of our wealth overseas, that's happening because the Chinese people have the money to buy the widgets and stuff that we've been buying from them. And secondly, they want to slowly disengage from putting all their dollars or their money in their reserves in dollars. And as they get to a position where they can then pull the plug on us, that's when they'll really have blackmail power on us.
Okay, thanks very much, Roger. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I was back in Washington, D.C. a few months ago. It was actually a few weeks ago. I talked to a man named Al Santoli, who I think is certainly the most knowledgeable person I know on what's really going on in China, because he reads all of the military publications after they've been translated into English. And the Chinese feel that the man that they respect the most in the world today is George Soros. Because George Soros has taught them how to collapse the economy of a country by destroying its currency. And he's done that in the Middle East, not in the Middle East, but in the Southeast Asia,
right.
In Thailand and in Malaysia. And he toppled those countries' currencies. And they are in their own writings talking about how when the time comes, they're going to do it here in the United States. Now, you're not hearing that, but it's in the Chinese own publications. Our government knows that. And for some strange reason, why we're giving the Chinese communists the wherewithal to destroy America. Now, why would you do something that stupid unintentionally? But then, why would you give them technology so they can build a very accurate MIRV intercontinental ballistic missiles, so they can attack our country, so they can give that technology to Pakistan, so they can give it to Iran, so they can give it to North Korea, so they can give it to Saudi Arabia, because they all have very accurate missiles now built with American technology. And people have said, oh, Bill Clinton did it because he wanted to get $100,000 or $200,000 in, of course, campaign contributions. And if you believe that, you believe anything. I believe we're in real trouble, because I believe there are spiritual forces guiding this whole thing, that God throughout history has brought other nations to punish Israel. And I believe, of course, America was chosen by God. It was a favored nation. We've abandoned our religious roots. And I believe that God's judgment is going to come on this country, not only militarily, but financially. And certainly we see the moral breakdown. Ron, we're out of time. Do you have one quick thought for our listeners before we let you go?
Well, I would agree with what you're saying. I think we've turned away from God, and God has got to get us back on our knees. And that while as good stewards, we want to do what we can to protect ourselves from destruction by this bogus system, that is not our salvation. Our only hope is in Jesus Christ, and that our real salvation is an extra pair of knee pads, because that's where our hope's going to come from, is in peace with him.
I agree with you totally, Ron, and thank you so very much for being with us again. If you'd like to get hold of Ron, his telephone number is 800-595-0561. That's 595-0561. And Ron is certainly one of our supporters, has helped us, and we appreciate having him on. And I just wanted to have this talk on this evening because I have a sense of urgency. And if you're out there in the listening audience, make preparations. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Ron, thanks so very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye and God bless. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when, of course, we have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon. I do what I do 5 hours a day because I really feel that we have to get this message out. We've got to point people towards the fact we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men, and America, of course, has lost that battle because America has turned against God, and we may only be talking to a remnant. I pray that there will be a revival in America, but my job is to reach as many people as I can with the hope that they'll reach other people who reach other people. We still have the greatest nation in the world and the greatest people in the world, but of course most of the people are being led by false leaders going right along with this whole concept, we've got to support the war over there in Iraq, we've got to support our boys. We need to support our boys. We need to bring our boys home and stop interfering with other countries, because we're turning the whole Islamic world, the whole world against us. And believe me, when we go into a financial Armageddon, there's not going to be anybody out there throwing us a life raft. Because, of course, America has more hatred for it today than we've ever had before. We squandered all the good feelings, all the goodwill that we had after 9/11 by going to war and lying to the American people about why we were going to war with Iraq. The war with Iraq was planned long before 9/11. And you must understand that. You need to get our video, Iraq, the Untold Story. That's Iraq, the Untold Story. You can get a syllabus with it that I give you the documentation for everything we say. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin. I think it's the finest book we have on monetary issues. It will explain how the whole fiat money system works, how they create money out of nothing, and how they've been robbing successive generations, the people. Although Ed doesn't get so much into the spiritual aspect of it, he does an excellent job. On the financial aspect, there's no better book out there than The Creature from Jekyll Island. And then, of course, you will want to get Professor Sutton's little book, short book, very concise and to the point, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. That's The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Anthony Sutton, who was a friend of mine. His other book on gold, and you really want to get his book on gold, because this is the time you have to understand that gold is the basis of monetary systems. It has been for 6,000 years. And then, of course, the little book, Fiat Money, Inflation in France, will explain to you what happened in France in 1789 when they went into the same sort of a monetary system that we have, and with the moral breakdown, the loss of integrity, the total corruption of the politicians. There's nothing new under the sun. It's like deja vu all over again. It's going on today. If you don't understand the past, though, you can't understand what's going on. That is The Creature from Jekyll Island, the fiat money inflation in France, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. We think those three books are great. And then we have a video. It's called Phenomenon, The Monopoly Men. And you'll actually hear Milton Friedman there talking about how the Federal Reserve System created the Great Depression of 1929. And you'll hear Milton Friedman telling how the Federal Reserve System created the Great Depression of 1929, exactly as they're creating exactly what is going to happen. Why? Because if they destroy our currency, then we will be forced to go into a cashless society, a new one-world currency, a new world order, a new world religion. Or again, our number 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. The number again, 1-800-544-8927. And then pray for America. Pray for revival, but please remember to pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, when we'll be with you again here at the same time, same station, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.